Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Content warning, this episode involves discussion of the murder of two girls.
There have been a few things going on recently in the cases involving Kegan Klein and Richard Allen, and we thought it would be a good idea to take a few moments and discuss them all with you.
My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
We first connected while looking into the Burger Chef murders, an Indiana cold case. Together, we built a spreadsheet documenting hundreds of cases of restaurant-related homicides. That original spreadsheet gave way to our podcast, The Murder Sheet.
Now we maintain that same research-centric, investigative approach as we look into all sorts of homicides, including unsolved cases, historical crimes, and, of course, restaurant murders.
We don't just chat about the headlines. Our podcast is a platform for our journalism. The Murder Sheet focuses on investigative reporting, thoughtful analysis, thorough research, and in-depth interviews.
We're The Murder Sheet.
And this is The Delphi Murders, Sentencing, Suppression, and Secrecy.
Let's start with what's happening with Kegan Klein. Mm-hmm. When last we heard from Kegan Klein, when we interviewed him a couple of weeks back, and after he appeared in court at the sentencing hearing, he was making some interesting suggestions. He was basically indicating that he had not been given a chance to see all of the evidence against him. He was suggesting that might be the fault of the prosecution, it might be the fault of his defense attorney. But he told us in the interview that he believed he was not guilty of all of the things he said he was guilty of?
25 charges in total. I think he indicated that he was guilty of 7.
And that he felt that some of this evidence, which he allegedly had not seen, might prove that he was, in fact, not guilty of the things he said he was guilty of. Because, again, he had earlier pled guilty count by count to all of those things.
Yes, Judge Timothy Spahr took him through each charge and would specifically ask him, do you plead guilty to this? Do you understand this? And he went through all of that. But then there was this big kind of almost twist in the case at his sentencing hearing, or what was supposed to be his sentencing hearing, when he basically indicated that he wanted to potentially change his plea. And then he also reiterated that to us in our interview with him, wanting to change his plea from on at least some of the charges, not all of them necessarily, but some of them.
He at least said he wanted to think about it.
Yeah, he was thinking about it.
Because he felt, again, that there might be some evidence which might support his contention that maybe someone else did some of these crimes.
Yes. So we were very interested in that strategy. Sort of seemed like a big change from going to basically saying, I did all this and I'm sorry, to...
Well, actually...
Nope, not all of it. And, you know, that definitely got a lot of people's attention, and the, you know, Delphi case rumor mill starts, you know, running of, is something happening? Is a plea deal being worked out? At the time, we were like, no, you know, this is Kagan Klein's choice. He's doing this. And, you know, that's kind of, he seems to be doing things just sort of on impulse to a certain degree, at least on the outside. He kind of explained his thinking to us. So, he, you know, that's his perspective. But on the outside, a lot of these things, including, you know, pleading guilty without, you know, going to trial and not requiring, you know, a jury to weigh this, seemed kind of impulsive. And then so did taking it back. So.
And then there was, as you all will remember, there was a lot of activity around that. He ended up getting new lawyers. He ended up, Judge Spahr wanted to err on the side of being overly fair to the defendant Klein and gave him some time to examine this evidence, which he allegedly had not seen. Then on May 31st, there was a new filing. Can you read that, Anya?
Comes now the defendant, Kagan A. Klein, and having had an opportunity to review all the evidence in the above-captioned matter, and having consulted with my attorneys in this matter, William F. Berkshire and Eric Hunter Yeager, do hereby wish to proceed with the plea which was entered as a judgment in this court on April 4th, 2023, and proceed to sentencing in this matter on July 27th, 2023, at 9 a.m. This is my free and voluntary decision. Respectfully, Kagan A. Klein.
Okay, so basically he's saying, well, originally I pled guilty, then I had second thoughts, and now I'm having second thoughts about my second thoughts, and I'm going to stick with my guilty pleas. And this suggests a couple of things. First of all, it supports the prosecution's contention. They said, we absolutely sent him all of the evidence. There was no evidence we were hiding that would establish this man's innocence in these crimes. I believe the fact that he's sticking with his guilty plea supports that. Kagan Klein also suggested that his own former attorney, Andrew Ackie, he suggested, well, maybe Andrew Ackie was the one who kept all of this secret evidence from me that would exonerate me. That also does not appear to be true, because Kagan Klein has now looked at all the evidence. He's had the opportunity to try to sleuth out his possible innocence and has been unable to do so. So this supports the idea that Andrew Ackie also did not hide any evidence from him.
Yes. And I mean, we kind of, to a certain extent, thought that something like this might happen. Because again, there's been so many different kind of bizarre twists and turns here. When you kind of come to expect that, when I think you come to expect that a lot, it's a lot less surprising when you see this. But basically, this means that seemingly for now, we're full steam ahead until July 27th at 9 a.m. when there's going to be presumably a sentencing.
Yeah, I'm sure all the people who showed up for the previous sentencing hearing that wasn't will show up for this one. some of the detectives who've worked on the case. We know that Prosecutor Jen Kiefer has indicated that she plans to introduce some evidence on the issue of possession of child pornography or child sexual abuse materials. So it should be an interesting hearing. And I just want to say, I want to stress the fact that I felt what Kagan did by suggesting that Andrew Ackie had behaved inappropriately, I think we said this at the time, it really put Mr. Ackie in an awkward position. I'll always remember when I was in law school, you have to take ethics classes, and we were told that attorney-client privilege was so sacred that even if your client out and out lied about something you said or did in the scope of your representation of that client, you could not correct him. You would have to abide by whatever your client says. And it's difficult in life when people say things about you that may not be true or may not be wholly true. It's difficult even in the best of circumstances, but I imagine it's much more difficult when you're not even allowed to reply.
Right. Yeah, that's so important to remember, because I think when people see that, like, okay, someone's making an accusation and the other person hasn't, you know, loudly defended themselves, what does that mean? But I think you can't really read into that here, because he literally can't. Like, you know, if you're my lawyer and I say that you, you know, tripped and fell in the mud and looked like a fool, you can't defend yourself from me. Not that I would do that to you, Kevin, but, you know, it kind of highlights the point. And, you know, we did reach out to Mr. Ackie for a comment on this, and he obviously couldn't give one. So, and that struck, I mean, the prosecution, they were very much denying what Kagan was claiming, saying, we got, you know, Kagan's defense team all the documents they needed. This is nonsense. There's nothing here. So they were very much vehemently defending themselves. But I think it's a really important point about Mr. Ackie and just, you know, defense attorneys in general, representing people in general. There's a lot of rules about what you can and cannot do, what you can and cannot say, and that played into things here.
And I want to, again, also stress that based on what we know about Kagan, it's very difficult to get inside Kagan's head. But based on what we know about him, if there was anything in this alleged new evidence that he could plausibly use to argue innocence, I'm sure he would try to do so.
Well, one thing he indicated to us in his conversation with us is that law enforcement in general has kind of taken the tact with him. And I can believe this, that if they can't corroborate his statements, they can't necessarily do anything based on that. And I think that's important to remember. That doesn't necessarily mean that he's a person who, you know, is incapable of telling the truth, but it does mean that he's a person where him making a statement on its own is not necessarily going to be enough for anybody else to be charged or implicated, because, you know, it's just not enough. It's not trustworthy enough. He's diminished a lot of his credibility. And even, frankly, if he hadn't, then it would still, you know, you can't just arrest somebody based on, like, one person's word. Typically, there has to be, like, some evidence backing it up. You know, that's just how the legal system works. It's not enough to just have one person pointing the finger at another party or saying, I have information on this. You know, and when you take people too seriously who may have some sort of motivation for confessing or making a statement, then you get into like a Henry Lee Lucas situation where people are just, you know, ascribing tons of murders to like one person, or, you know, jailhouse snitches are infamous for, you know, coming in and having an incentive to lie about their cellmate, making some damaging claims. I mean, these are all things that we've seen throughout, you know, our understanding of criminal cases. And so I just think that's important to note. But I mean, at the same time, like, it's kind of, is it a boy who cried wolf situation? Because, you know, like, if there is anything of substance that he has to say, it would be pretty hard to pick that out of everything else he said, right?
Are you talking about as it pertains to Delphi or pertains to his own case?
Here's the thing. I've said this before. I'm interested in what he has to say about Delphi, at the very least as an academic exercise, because I think essentially he is a person whose house was raided, you know, like about a week and a half after the murders. They were looking into him as part of the murders. We know that. That's all very well documented at this point. That doesn't mean the police were correct or they had the right guy, but it does mean that he came on the radar because of what happened in Delphi, at least in part. And so getting his perspective on what that experience is like is interesting to me, whether or not he turns out to be directly relevant to what happened to Libby and Abby, because it's like, how did things proceed down this one lead? Maybe it was blind alley. Maybe it was a red herring. That's certainly possible. But it's still relevant to the story of the case because it tells you what the investigation was doing at the time. And that to me is always going to be much more interesting than like, oh, let's, you know, stroke our chins and conjecture about random local civilians on Reddit or whatever. You know, to me, what the police are actually doing is more newsworthy and interesting than, you know, what the amateur sleuth community is doing. And that's why we've covered things like Ron Logan, right? Because it's like, okay, what were they doing in March 2017? Well, there was a very big push around Ron Logan, right? That's when that was sort of happening. And so, yeah, I'm very interested in what he has to say just as his perspective. I'm still open to the possibility that he knows more, but I'm not necessarily banking on that because, you know, and also, even if he were to say, I know the answers, I mean, okay, but that has to be corroborated, obviously.
Yeah, I remember there's a witness in the Burger Chef case, Alan Pruitt, and someone I used to work with on that case told me once, you know, he said, Kevin, even if we went and talked to Alan Pruitt and he said, I did it. At this point, it's impossible to take anything this man says seriously. And I think we're very close, if not already, to that point with Kagan Klein.
Yeah, you just have to kind of see what he says. And I think with this, I think this is a lesson for Delphi in general, for people following the case. You hear people out, but you don't necessarily like bank all your conclusions on what they're saying. You know, I mean, like that's why I went, like when we cover things about Kagan's statements to police, like, for example, the red Jeep, he's claiming he's in this red Jeep, you know, at the time of the murders. Okay. You know, that's interesting. We know for a fact that he did say that to police, but we were very careful in that episode and in, you know, subsequent discussions of that incident to say, but that's just what he's saying. You know, he could say I was flying in a jet at the time. I mean, like, you have to. OK, but if that's the case, then where's your jet ticket? You know, is there footage of you at the airport? You know, how can we back that up? Because otherwise it's just words. Anybody is capable of saying anything. That doesn't make it true. And more importantly, it doesn't make it provable. You know, like cases in our system are based upon what you can prove, what the evidence can prove. It's not just like conjecture, this sounds good, you know, or this sounds like something the killer would say. It has to be proven to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. So I just think that's all very important to keep in mind. We've always tried to say, you know, it's Kagan, so this is a statement that he's making. Take it with a grain of salt. Take it with a whole thing of salt. But, you know, I think he's still a relevant figure because at the very least, some of his crimes were likely uncovered due to the Delphi investigation.
And as Anya mentioned, the next court date involving Kagan Klein is his sentencing at July 27th at 9 a.m. And we will be there. There was actually a status hearing scheduled for June 8th. Which was canceled because since he's pleading guilty, there's really no need for such a hearing. I frankly was a little bit disappointed it was canceled because June 8th was the first day of Peru's Cole Porter Festival. And I think you and I might still slip over to Peru to go to that Cole Porter Festival over the weekend.
It's a super cool town. We love Peru and it's got a lot of cool things going on beside this kind of upsetting and awful case. So
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crow portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
All right, so now I think we can move on to the case against Richard Allen, who of course has been charged with murdering Libby and Abby in the Delphi murders case. Now, a couple of new things have happened recently, and we sort of wanted to take a moment to discuss all of them together. And one of them pops up in his My Case. It's labeled Motion for Ex Parte Determination of Defendant's Motion for Appointment of Experts. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a lot of words.
That's a lot of ofs.
Well, the first thing, we can all see that it says in there that the defense wants to appoint certain experts. We understand that. But what does ex parte mean, and why is the judge involved? So to understand that, we need to take a step back and remember that Richard Allen is not paying for his own attorneys. If you are rich enough to be able to pay for your own defense attorneys in a murder case and you have those kind of resources, you can basically hire whatever experts you want because you're paying for it. But Richard Allen's attorneys are public defenders, which means that they are being paid by the state. And that means someone has to come in and approve whether or not the state will approve the hiring of certain witnesses and approve those funds. Now, ex parte means that not all the parties in the case will be involved in a particular hearing. And that makes sense because certainly the judge should have the right to weigh in on whether or not these experts that the defense wants are necessary. But it doesn't make sense for the prosecution to come in and get to decide who the defense gets to use and who the defense doesn't get to use, because that wouldn't basically be playing fair. That would be like if you're a baseball team and the team you're playing against gets to decide what players you use.
And there's a bit of a kind of, you know, I think a perception of an imbalance here, because I think people are like, well, the defense gets to know what the prosecution's doing, so why doesn't the prosecution get to know what the defense is doing? And the reason for that is pretty simple. The prosecution has the full bearing of the powers of the state and law enforcement on its side, and the defense does not.
And of course, there are no surprises in a trial. So if the prosecution doesn't get to weigh in on the decision of whether or not they will hire a particular expert, but if they hire an expert and consult with that expert and they decide, well, what this expert has to say is important enough to be heard at the trial, then they would notify the prosecution of that fact so they can prepare.
But at the same time, the prosecution also doesn't get to know ahead of time because, I mean, basically, if the defense hires, like, let's say, a, you know, gunpowder residue expert, right, and the prosecution knows this, then the prosecution gets a list of the defense witnesses, and that guy's nowhere to be seen. He realizes, the prosecutor in this case would realize that, okay, maybe that guy got back to them with some insights that they didn't like. So I'm going to really hammer that or look into it or kind of piece that together, you know, reverse engineer it so that it benefits me. And so, you know, that would be, you know, under the system, that would be considered unfair. And so they don't want to get into a situation where that happens, right?
Right.
There was an ex parte hearing early on in this case, if we recall, where the defense was trying to, you know, look into experts and, you know, getting the services of experts and paying for that. So this is not the first ex parte hearing that has occurred. We've seen this before. It's more of the same thing.
And there was also, the defense also filed a motion for continuing disclosure of defendants' mental health records. That's pretty vaguely worded, so it's not clear what exactly that means.
But it does indicate that, at the very least, that Allen's mental health seems to be becoming an issue in this case, correct?
Correct.
So we've seen this before. Allen, famously, the defense put out in a filing photos of Allen, or a photo of Allen taken at the Westfield Correctional Facility, a prison in Indiana, and, you know, kind of showing him emaciated, disheveled, seemingly not doing very well, having lost a ton of weight. And they, in that filing, indicated that he is having psychotic symptoms, essentially, and is his mental health is being very damaged by his incarceration. We've had plenty of experts on to talk about that, talk about different possibilities around that. But obviously, you know, it does not seem like there's been any slowdown in Allen's mental state being a topic of conversation throughout this pretrial phase.
And of course, it's also always technically a possibility that his mental health could come into play in a possible defense. We're getting into heavy speculative territory here because as far as we know and as far as we understand, the attorneys for Mr. Allen have always made clear that they believe he's factually innocent of this crime. In other words, they don't believe he committed these murders. But if for some reason at some point that might change, it's possible they might try to use mental health or insanity basically as some sort of defense. But there's no sign that they're doing that, and so we don't really need to explore that too much at this time.
Yeah, there's no sign it's imminent because, again, as Kevin said, factual innocence has been the order of the day for the defense so far. We're just bringing it up just because, you know, the mental capacity does seem to be sort of a recurring theme here. It's not just about a defense, though. It's also about, like, whether somebody's fitness for trial, right? Can they assist in their own defense? You can't put someone out there who cannot assist in their own defense and is not competent to stand trial. So that's also a thing that we'd be looking at with this. That's not saying, oh, he did it because he was insane. It's more of saying, like, you know, he can't stand trial right now because he just couldn't handle it, basically. But I think that we're far way off from that. I think it just, we bring it up because it's just with the mental illness, mental health situation coming up so much, it's something we're thinking about a bit.
Yeah, we just like to be thorough. And again, the defense has made it clear that they believe that Richard Allen is factually innocent of these crimes. Mm-hmm.
So now let's go on to something that we had been expecting to happen, but now we don't expect to happen because it's changed. There were previously 2 days, June 15th and June 16th, 2023, set aside for a bail hearing for Richard Allen. So that's an opportunity for a mini trial to take place where the state has to argue, here's evidence to indicate that he needs to be kept incarcerated, and where the defense can say, no, here's why he should be let out on his own recognizance until trial. So that was going to happen. We were very excited for it because it was basically going to be like a chance for, like, I mean, there's going to be testimony. It was going to be potentially very interesting.
Because to date, we've actually gotten very little evidence in this case. We have very little idea of what the actual case against Richard Allen is.
Yeah.
And that was going to change.
Yeah. But nope, it's not going to change after all because that's been essentially canceled and converted into a suppression hearing. So there's going to be no bail hearing. Instead, on June 15th, and this will likely be something that only happens on June 15th. It likely will not be 2 days. There's going to be a suppression hearing instead. The defense requested for a change to take place where they would essentially, you know, cancel the bond hearing, put in a suppression hearing in its place.
And I'm sure you all have a lot of questions about what exactly a suppression hearing is and what's involved. And we're actually working on an episode on that, which we will get out probably on next Tuesday. But with that said, I think it's worth noting that we don't know what exactly this motion for suppression involves. In other words, we don't know what it is the defense wants to suppress. And there's actually a lot of things we don't know about this case, as we all know, because so many of the filings in this case are rather inexplicably being kept secret and being kept away from the public.
Which brings us to our next topic. We're going to try to do something about that.
Don't know if it'll work, but
probably won't.
It's worth a try.
Yes. Sometimes you got to, you know, just go for it. We are going to try to put together a filing that, you know, essentially protests the fact that multiple filings in this case are being seemingly automatically sealed without any regard for trial proceeding rules and just various basically standards that you're supposed to meet in order to seal things.
Yeah, and let's be clear. I think all of us can imagine circumstances where it's appropriate for certain documents filed in a case to be kept secret. And there are many circumstances where that's completely appropriate. And in those circumstances, though, the person doing the filing is supposed to also file something with the court saying this needs to be kept confidential. In this case, we're seeing things being kept routinely confidential and sealed, even in those instances where there doesn't appear to be any filings from the defense or the prosecution asking for it to be sealed.
To put it in a sort of an educational sort of analogy, we're not saying that the answers to the math problems that you filled out are wrong. We're just saying that we would feel a lot more comfortable if you actually showed your work of how you came to those conclusions. So that's what we're trying to do, is encourage the work to be shown and essentially do things by the book, because I think this is a very important case. We want to see things done by the book so that, you know, so that it bolsters our confidence in that of the public's that everything is being handled properly. As Kevin said, it's not a goal to get everything out there, because there's certainly things that should not be out there pretrial. Stuff that would be unfair to Richard Allen, the defendant. And also stuff that could mess up, you know, any sort of ongoing investigation that the prosecution is working on. We don't want to see that happen. You know, both of those things would not be good. But I think it's fair to say, you know, if you're going to be sealing things, you should be indicating why and following the proper procedures and proper channels to do that, as opposed to just unilaterally doing it. I feel like this needs to be challenged because, I mean, this is a case that it has engendered an extraordinary public interest. The public wants to know about this. The public, to a certain degree, has a right to know about this. And if things are being kept in the dark, fine, but explain why.
And I think we've talked about this in the past. I think some of this secrecy is to the detriment of some of the governmental agencies involved. It's certainly to the detriment of the people who deserve to have some sort of power of oversight over the agencies that operate in their name. I'm thinking back to, we remember back in April, the defense filed a motion basically alleging abuse of Richard Allen in the prison system.
And putting blame squarely on the Carroll County Sheriff's Office.
Now, those are very serious allegations. I think we would all be very, very interested in a response to them from Carroll County. Whatever response they made, we have not been allowed to see. Maybe there's a response that would completely blow the claims of the defense out of the water. We don't know. I think the people have the right to see this. I think people should have the right to know what this motion to suppression is about. There's so many filings in here that in other cases would be made public. There was that mysterious letter from a Westville correctional inmate a few weeks back. What was that about? Who knows?
And it's like a matter of, you know, it's not just this. It's that, you know, witnesses, family members, public officials, law enforcement, prosecution, and defense attorneys are being gagged by the gag order, which is incredibly broad. And, you know, that's preventing people from speaking out on this as well. So you have a situation where it's not just one area that is being kept secretive. It is a culture of secrecy that, you know, continues to pervade this case that certainly predates the arrest of Richard Allen, but at the same time is certainly being cemented by some of these actions when it comes to the gag order and the bizarre sealing of every single document here. I think we just feel passionately about this being handled properly, and we'd like to basically do a filing that kind of just says, hey, you know, follow the rules. And, you know, that's our interest here. It's not about just getting stuff unilaterally, published, because we can understand where, you know, the Westville Correctional Inmate Letter. It's possible that they don't want that out there because the person who sent that could be put, you know, into a situation where they're labeled a snitch in one of Indiana's most tough prisons. That would be endanger their lives. Nobody wants to see that happen. So I think that's fine to, you know, I think it's fine to have redactions. I think it's fine to have certain things completely sealed. We would just like to see it being done through the proper channels and, you know, with the kind of level of openness that at least, you know, you can be explaining to the public, all right, we got to keep this out of here because it's sensitive and names witnesses and blah, blah, blah. I just don't think having the prosecution and having this these pretrial motions be just sort of sealed without explanation is, in our opinion, just not acceptable.
And going back to the gag order, that by its very language, it was limited to extrajudicial comment. That means it doesn't seem to apply to comment within the court system, so it shouldn't apply to these filings. So we're just going to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably not going to work out because, I mean, we're going up against a system that seems very determined to keep everything as secretive as possible. But I don't think we'd feel good about ourselves covering this case if we didn't at least try something of like, okay, what? What are you doing? But yeah, we're always going to be favoring transparency over murkiness because I frankly, forgetting anything about like, media or whatever, I think that better serves the public, better serves the case.
Exactly.
But anyways, that we're giving you a preview of all this because if you see a filing that, you know, we're on in a certain respect, then that's why. It's not because we've, you know, been arrested or something. we're just trying to intervene essentially as a media entity trying to spark a change, but That's what you can read into it. It's not something else or whatever conjecture will get spun out on, you know, certain online corners. All right. Well, that's, I think, basically the recent discussions about Kagan Klein's case and Richard Allen's case. We appreciate you guys listening. And of course, always let us know if you have any questions about these cases that we can answer on the show.
Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Sheet. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for The Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much. We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.